Hello, my name is Zhang Kwan, and I'm the editor of the DPRK Food Policy Blog. Today, I will be guest hosting for Worldwise on Blogging Heads TV, and I'm here today with Chris Green, who is the manager of international affairs for Daily NK and co-editor of Sino-NK, both excellent sources of news analysis on North Korea. Chris has written and spoken widely on a range of issues related to North Korea and will no doubt continue to be a presence in the North Korea studies community for years to come. Did I miss anything in your illustrious career, Chris?
It's not so illustrious, but no, you didn't miss anything. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great. When we last spoke together for a program of Worldwide in August 2012, you provided listeners with a very concise and informative summary of North Korea's recent history. No doubt Blogging Heads TV will link the last video to this one. Since then, North Korea has launched another rocket, scrapped the rumored plans for economic reforms, conducted another nuclear test, closed and reopened the joint South Korean-North Korea industrial complex at Kaesong, and last month, Pyongyang made world headlines again with the very public purge of Jang Sung-taek, a high-profile member in North Korea's central government and uncle of the current leader, Kim Jong-un. And the popular story making rounds right now is that Jang Sung-taek was executed by having 120 dogs, which were starved for 3 days, released on him. It seems some analysts have discovered that this news actually came from a Chinese satire. Now, you've written before on North Korea's rumor mill and have expressed doubts on the story from the start. As someone who deals with raw stories coming from North Korea, working with Sino-NK and Daily NK, what are some things people should look for when assessing stories like this coming from North Korea?
I have written about the rumor mill more generally. In the case of this story, I'm pleased to say that we are recording this at a time when that story's more or less been completely debunked. But in the context of that story, which came to the public's attention via the Straits Times in Singapore most recently, although some people had been speaking about something similar for a few days, seems to have stemmed from a Hong Kong-based tabloid, may have come from some satire inside China, but I mean, I'm not quite sure about that part. What's interesting about that, and how it feeds into the rumor mill stuff that I've written about before, is that if you are able to check with sources inside North Korea as to whether or not they've heard such a story, that's in fact one of the best ways to verify, at the very least, not necessarily the truth or falsity of the story itself, but where it may have derived from. And in the case of that 120 dog story, subsequently being debunked, initially, what we did at my company was check with our sources inside North Korea and ask them, have you heard this story or have you heard any extraordinarily strange stories or any stories about Jang Sung-taek? And they say no, and yet there is this incredibly popular story in the international media. Then you have a problem because it shows that that story hasn't emanated from inside North Korea. And if it hasn't emanated from inside North Korea, then it's probably false, or at least that cast doubt upon it. And so that was a very interesting story.
But certainly there are certain rumors that do emanate from North Korea that are still doubtful in terms of its validity, right?
Sure.
Have you ever encountered situations where you do find that the source of the rumors are coming from North Korea, but they are still fantastic and are might be misleading in terms of our better understanding of the regime?
There can be those occasions. I suppose it's worth pointing out perhaps the bigger picture, which is that there is an awful lot of incentive in the case of a lot of different groups to have certain rumors and stories spread around. The North Korean authorities tend not to release information publicly, except when it suits them to do so. But there are, as a result of the fact that information doesn't spread freely inside North Korea, they do obviously have an incentive sometimes to spread rumors to achieve certain goals, be it instilling fear or perpetuating the idea that certain people have certain interests. I mean, there are competing interest groups inside North Korea, competing factions who may want to spread certain stories or certain narratives about themselves or others. So we can see that, and of course, we mustn't forget that the international media has an incentive in the most interesting stories that are available. And so we can see that every group has a stake And so it can become very difficult to pass all of the various stories that are out there to reach some kind of conclusion about which ones are at least most likely to be true.
I think we'll come back to perhaps more of the rumor issues and the Jangsung Tech issue later on in the conversation. But I think currently the other news that's making headlines is the Dennis Rodman visit to North Korea. And obviously a lot of people have been drawing parallels between his trip and the ping-pong diplomacy that brought China and U.S. together in the 1970s. Do you see any benefits to Dennis Rodman's visit to Pyongyang?
Outright benefits? Not particularly. Detriments? Also, no, not particularly. I think it's just a sort of a story that carries with it an inherent weirdness that doesn't, in and of itself, do any favors for those of us who are trying to normalize the analysis of North Korea. So from that perspective, you shrug your shoulders and get on with it. There are people, mostly conservative people, who say that by going to North Korea in this way, you are giving benefit to the Kim Jong-un regime. There are other people who naysay this and say, what kind of benefit could that possibly be? But we find today that there are business people from China, investors from China, who were invited to visit Pyongyang to commemorate the January 8th birthday of Kim Jong-un. And as part of their itinerary, they're attending, or attended, I suppose it's been and gone now, this basketball match, this friendly between Dennis Rodman and his group of associates from the NBA and some North Korean players. So you can see that that is a benefit, right? I mean, you talk about that as an engagement policy. You talk about that as an attempt to reach out to North Korea. Or if you're Dennis Rodman, you simply say that you wanted to play basketball in Pyongyang for Kim Jong-un's birthday, which is a little bit odd. But it's obviously been instrumentalized for the benefit of the regime as a way of saying thank you to certain investors who've given significant amounts of money to the country. So we can see that it's a very complicated story. But in the bigger picture, does it make any difference? Perhaps not.
Do you think there are any benefits to perhaps eroding the distrust that North Korean public have for Americans, given the decades of propaganda on American intentions and such?
Well, to be fair, there is some research being done by someone associated with Sino-NK, Peter Ward, who's discussing the fact that the military, the American military, has always been attacked in literature in North Korea, but American people, for example, haven't been. So it's a question of what would you be eroding? If you are coming to this conversation under the impression that there is only unalloyed hatred in North Korean literature for American people, then that's probably incorrect. It's mostly the military that gets the brunt of it, or the officialdom in Washington, D.C. So it's a bit more nuanced than perhaps we give it credit for.
I think that's an interesting point, given the most people don't think about nuance in North Korean propaganda, but I guess here it's quite important to make a distinction.
There is some nuance in there, most certainly.
But, so going back to perhaps the more substantial issues that are affecting North Korea right now, going back to the Jangsung Tech purge, Jangsung Tech was often described as Kim Jong-un's right-hand man or regent by some media. What was his actual and formal role in the central government in Pyongyang?
Well, it depends from which direction you look at it. There are some who said he had a limited degree of power, in particular in terms of the enforcement of the regime structure. On the other hand, he was a member of the Kim family, which had always been considered the ultimate guarantor of one's security. It was, one might be declared a quote-unquote side branch of the Kim family. One might be shipped off to Warsaw to become the ambassador. One might be warned not to return to North Korea, as perhaps Kim Jong-nam was. But at least one could guarantee one's personal safety. And that was the way he was seen by a lot of people, but it turned out not to be the case. Officially, he was the director of department of the Workers' Party, which was hived off in 2007 from the Organisation and Guidance Department, which is an extraordinarily powerful element of the Workers' Party. So that was hived off and given to him. It appears to have been taken, well, it has been taken back now, but it appeared to have been taken back before. So it was very difficult to say precisely how much power he had. He had very good connections to China. So you can say that he was one of the main lines, financial lines to China. Now, how much is money important in North Korea? That's the question you have to answer in that case, because the Organization and Guidance Department obviously is the enforcer of the way the regime is structured. And if Jiang didn't have power there, then how much power did he really have, right? If he didn't have money, he didn't have anything, except for his links to the Kim family, which people had assumed would secure his future. So obviously it's a very complicated situation and very hard to say with any certainty who really always is safe or has the power in that kind of structure.
Now, you mentioned Jiang Zemtek's contact with China.
Yeah.
And we've noticed that in the immediate aftermath of Jiang Zemtek's purge, despite Beijing's official line that this is North Korea's internal matter, China conducted drills along the border, military drills along the border. And there have been a lot of discussions regarding Jiang's role in the Sino-North Korean relations. In particular, Professor Andrei Lankov noted the possibility of the purge having a natural negative effect on China. And yet some of the deals that North Korea and China had made, such as the high-speed rail project, are seemingly going through despite the removal of Jiang Zemtek. Now, does this show that perhaps that Jiang Zemtek actually didn't have any power in North Korea to begin with in terms of its actual contributing to policymaking between North Korea and China? Or have there been any repercussions evident of the purge to the relations between the two countries?
I think that what North Korea went out of its way to do around the time of that purge was to convey the message that economic interactions continue as normal. Please don't worry about this, which proves nothing so much as that they haven't got any idea about how to engender investor confidence. But that's beside the point. They sent out officials or they sent missives to some of their Chinese investors saying, please don't concern yourselves, continue as normal. Around the time of the purge, they signed the railroad deal for a high-speed railway between Kaesong and Beijing. They reached out to South Korea for talks on Kaesong-related matters around the time of the purge. Again, whether they had any sincerity in wanting to have those talks, notwithstanding, they did at least reach out and say, we're going to have these talks. As you can see, economic matters continue unabated, irrespective of what's happening with Jiang Zemtek. So I think it's very hard to get to the bottom of this to analyze what kind of effect it would have. You probably need to wait 5 years to find out that kind of thing in economic terms. But at the very least, we can say that North Korea recognized that it needed to secure its investors to make sure that they felt as comfortable as it was feasible to make them feel. Perhaps we can look at today's story about inviting Chinese investors to come and celebrate Kim Jong-un's birthday in the same light, right? Because all of this stuff has come out in the media about how North Korea is unstable at this time. It seems set to continue now that we're talking about the health and security of Kim Jong-il's sister, Kim Jong-hee now. So that's obviously going to continue with these narratives of instability, what's happening to the Kim family, what's happening in North Korea. By inviting a posse of Chinese investors, people who've already put money into North Korea, down to Pyongyang, come to Pyongyang, meet Kim Jong-un, have dinner, we'll take you to this basketball game with this bunch of former NBA superstars here, just to prove that we're in charge here, there's no problem. I mean, we could definitely see today's activities in a similar vein, I think.
But there's obviously still in clarity in terms of what is actually happening in Pyongyang and what the image that Pyongyang is trying to project abroad, right? So, like, a lot of people have been asking questions on what the purge represented. And some people do say that the Jiang Zemtek purge represented a power struggle between factions, and that this shows that the very public, the unprecedented public nature of the purge shows that the internal power structure within, around Kim Jong-un is very weak, while others note that this is actually the concentration of central authority around Kim Jong-un. So what are your thoughts on the merits of these assessments, and what are perhaps, in the Rumsfeldian term, known unknowns in the analysis?
I think we should leave Rumsfeld out of this. Has he not done enough damage?
I quite like the term known unknowns.
Known unknowns is good, I quite agree. Because
it seems like a lot of it reminds the readings on North Korea following the Changsung-tai purge seems to mirror in some ways a lot of the literature that had been developed around the Kremlin about the internal power struggles around different factions in the Communist Party. And it seems like a lot of people have been using that, the same kind of analysis, to suggest that North Korea has internal power issues, that they have always had factional issues, and that the recent purge is simply a manifestation of internal power struggles showing that it's very weak. While others are suggesting that, no, actually, like, Changsung-tai never really had power, Kim Jong-un always had strong central authority. So, I mean, how should we go about analyzing North Korea? I mean, what are the merits of these assessments?
My personal perspective is that if you strip away all of the North Korea fluff, right, the unique stuff that only describes North Korea, what you ended up with, and this is why there were people back in 2011 saying Kim Jong-un is ultimately going to have to get rid of this guy, is that it's an authoritarian system in which power cannot be shared. Therefore, in the end, if there are twin centers of power, and you can argue that Jang Song-taek was one and wished to develop his more, I mean, after all, Kim Jong-un did say that Jang Song-taek should never be allowed to rise to party secretary because he's a dangerous man. So obviously he was keen on power. He may have thought that his links to the Kim family immunized him against the extremes of what might happen if you try and take power. So in the end, you faced a situation where Kim Jong-un or not, because it doesn't really matter whether it was Kim Jong-un or the organization and guidance department behind him, which is the New Focus International angle on this matter, but it doesn't really matter who it was. You had people perpetuating the Kim Jong-un leadership of North Korea, albeit as a figurehead or not, taking the power from this other locus of power, which was Jang Song-taek and his group. So that power grab was made. It's dangerous to make power grabs against people who have as much power as Jang Song-taek had at the time of the power grab was implemented. It is dangerous. It can lead to all kinds of unforeseen side effects. This is inevitable, that this would have to happen, because Kim Jong-un came to power. It was a transitional regime. Kim Jong-il had secured power in the 1990s. By the time he died, he was in near total control. I'm loath to use words totalitarian because it invites criticism, but he was in near total control. When Kim Jong-un came to power, he had to rebuild from the ground up, and there's only so much you can do riding on the coattails of your grandfather and father. Eventually, you're going to have to try and secure your own power structure, because these other two guys, well, they're dead, aren't they? So at the end of the day, he had to do something about that. And so he continues to take power from people in an attempt to ensure that ultimately he has dominant power over the coalition that runs the country. It's inevitable that he would have to do that. So to an extent, we can see the way North Korea runs through authoritarian political research that's gone before. I mean, this isn't particularly unique. And that's the way I see it.
Right. And speaking on the not particularly unique aspect, last time you appeared on Blogging Heads TV, there had just been the purge of Vice Marshal Ri Yong-ho in July of 2012.
Okay.
Yes, right. But the purge wasn't as public, and the KCNA reported that he had retired due to health concerns. The recent Changsung-taek purge appears to be the highest profile purge since the removal of the Vice Marshal. Given how these two figures had risen to power along Changsung-taek during the transition of power and the subsequent removal of these two men, do these things illuminate, perhaps add support to your argument that perhaps this is, regarding your last point, that this is was an inevitable process, that Ri's removal and both Jiangsen, and both Ri and Jiangsenghe's removal were inevitable.
Yeah, I think the two purges do illuminate the point I just made. People have been very quick to point out the very different nature of the two purges, and I suppose that's fully justified. I don't think it's possible for anyone to say precisely why the regime or whomever it was who implemented the purge of Jiangsenghe decided to do so in quite such a stunningly public manner. Perhaps it really was just Kim Jong-un's personality lent itself towards that kind of behaviour. Uncouth, over-enthusiastic, youthful, vicious, and unnecessary. Or perhaps there was more to it than that. Perhaps there is an overriding propaganda goal involved that required him to be removed in that public fashion. Maybe, given the nature of the judgment levelled against Jiang in the North Korean media, maybe he had really attempted something which was tantamount to planning, plotting the overthrow of Kim Jong-un. I mean, after all, there was a plotted coup against Kim Jong-il back in 1995-96, wasn't there? So we can't pretend that this kind of thing doesn't happen. But we can't really answer the question very compellingly why it was that they removed Ri Yong-ho in that way and Jiangsenghe in an entirely different one.
I mean, but there have following the purge, there have been also a lot of stories about defections of high-ranking officials from North Korea to China. Does this show that there were there was some kind of a power shift, or should we not read too deep into this?
Well, I think we should be careful because we don't even know who, if anyone, has defected. I mean, there were rumors of Noh Doo Chol defecting. I mean, he's a pretty high-level economic official, but then he appeared on the stage at one of the major events held not so long after the purge. So, I mean, until we see some concrete evidence of who has defected, what they've said, and how many people there are, I think we should be careful about passing further comment.
Right, okay. Perhaps we can shift our conversation slightly to the economic aspect of North Korea for a little bit. The FAO announced in their annual report in November 2013 that North Korea had increased its grain output, but also noted that winter harvest is still precarious. Despite this mixed assessment, rice prices have been remarkably stable in the past few months. Is this a sign that North Korea's food insecurity has turned the corner, or should we expect more turbulence in the coming years?
I don't know what we should expect in the coming years. I certainly don't think we should judge the coming years based on this year. And I also don't think we should leap to conclusions about why this year was relatively successful. There will inevitably be people who, in support of their belief that economic development in North Korea is taking place, will say that this is indicative of the implementation of economic and agricultural reforms. But, on the other hand, even the North Korean government doesn't say that its economic and agricultural reforms have been implemented nationwide. Rather, they say they're experimental. They say they're yielding good results, but of course they say that. It's not surprising. And indeed, they probably are, because it wouldn't take much to improve the agricultural policy mix in North Korea. But we shouldn't be claiming yet that this is an obvious big result of economic reform. Rather, it looks an awful lot like a year in which there was not an undue level of violently inclement weather, where the rains came at the right times, the weather was basically good, and it yielded good harvests. So I think, once again, I'm afraid it's a little too early to tell precisely what the causes of this year's good situation were, and therefore we can't make too many predictions about the future in terms of food security either.
Right. But should we look at the other economic developments that are occurring with North Korea? Like, it did last year, I believe, North Korea did show signs of GDP growth. It seems as though the bilateral economic ties with both Russia and China are moving forward, Do these all things perhaps suggest that North Korea is moving in a positive direction in terms of economic development?
I think they probably indicate that North Korea is moving in a positive direction in terms of economic development. Mind you, North Korea moved in a positive direction in terms of economic development in 1999, but that's not surprising because there'd just been 4 years of absolutely atrocious economic conditions. So we should be careful about where we start from in terms of these measurements. But although I suppose you can look at some of these economic developments and say North Korea is going in the right direction, you can also look at things like Mirim Riding Club, Munsu Water Park, Rungra Amusement Park there in Pyongyang. Even you look at Mashanyong Skiing Ground / Ski Resort in Gangwon-do, and you can see that although these things are marginally more productive than statues of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, they're hardly long-view projects for the North Korean economy that are going to return great amounts on the investments. So if North Korea is moving in the right direction, it's doing so in a very ad hoc and more by luck than judgment manner. That's how I would conclude it at this point.
The buzzword in North Korea studies for many years used to be juche, the idea of self-sufficiency. But it seems like the term Gyeongjin line is gathering greater interest among researchers. Is this something that we should look forward to in the future? And if so, what is the Gyeongjin line and what are the implications for the socioeconomic and political development of North Korea in the near future?
If you want to take the most optimistic view possible, then you would say that the Gyeongjin line represents the end of the military first policy, the end of the unabridged pursuit of nuclear weapons and military development for the security of the state, to be replaced by the co-development of the people's economy and the military-industrial complex. If you believe that, then perhaps in the long view you might see it as leading to the end of excessive investment in military period, followed by even greater investment in the people's economy, followed by economic development, followed by normalization as a state. That's the really hopeful view, but if you actually look at the propaganda output that surrounds the Gyeongjin line concept, you find a lot of it is still highly militaristic. It doesn't seem to suggest that there's going to be a shift massively towards people's economic investment, and it may also simply portend the further injection of military labor into the people's economy, which may or may not be a good thing. So I think it's a very complicated idea. It also, of course, harks back to the legacy politics idea forwarded to us by people like Honik Kwon and others over the last couple of years, whereby the legacy of Kim Il-sung is the vital legitimating factor in Kim Jong-un's leadership. In that case, then all the Gyeongjin line is a reminder that in 1962, Kim Il-sung also put forward the idea of military defense spending at the same time as people's economic development. And in that case, nothing's really changed. It's just looking back into history. So we'll have to wait and see, I think.
But what were some changes that occurred when Kim Jong, like the preceding, I guess, concept to the Gyeongjin line, it would be the Songun policy, right?
Yes.
In which case, the switch to Songun policy during the Kim Jong-il administration, what were the implications then, and what would be the implications of leaving the Songun policy behind?
It depends whether they actually leave it behind. It's very unlikely that North Korea would leave the Songun policy behind, and in any case, as you see, when they talk about North Korea nowadays, it's regularly mentioned in the same phrase as Songun. So it's Songun North Korea or Songun Chosun. So what the implications would be is an interesting hypothetical question, but it doesn't have any basis in reality yet. We'd have to wait and see. I mean, the government of North Korea can use ideology and propaganda positioning to achieve almost any goal it wants to, as long as it's given enough time to prepare the ground. But we can't be sure at this point how they're going to go with this.
Right. I mean, in Okay, so in terms of the goals of the central government in Pyongyang, what are the specific objectives that Pyongyang is seeking to achieve in terms of its defense capacity and its economic capacity? Is it the acquisition of ballistic nuclear weapons, or what is the end goal? Or is it the complete unification of the Korean Peninsula, or is it unspecific in terms of where they're going with the policies?
It was alleged many years ago by a number of people that the end goal was to miniaturize nuclear weapons, put them on a missile that could be delivered to the continental United States. That's not something I've ever seen in an official document, but it may be the truth. What do you think are the goals?
I mean, it seems like the goals for North Korea are quite unspecific. It seems like deterrence seems to be the main objective. So the capacity to project deterrent capacity through ballistic nuclear weapons seems to be the military aspect of it. But I do think that perhaps the announcement of certain changes like the June 28th reforms and subsequent economic experimentations in North Korea do show that perhaps the objectives are in flux in North Korea.
Yes, I mean, it doesn't matter what your objectives are if for some reason you can't achieve them, right? We've already established in this conversation that Kim Jong-un or the people around him don't have untrammeled power at this point, which means that in principle there could be competing points of view, in which case, although it may have been discredited back in Kim Jong-il's latter era, it may be the case that someone like Patrick McKeegan's thesis in the book Inside the Red Box has some merit at this point. And if that's the case, and if there are competing factions seeking to dominate North Korean politics going forward for the next, 20 odd years, then it's hardly surprising that the government would appear to be flip-flopping. Again, we just have to wait and see who emerges on top, see what kind of policy they pursue or instruct the leadership to pursue.
Perhaps ending the program on a slightly more lighter note, should we expect the North Korean basketball team to give us more of a blazing show in future Olympics as Dennis Rodman trains them in his skills and style?
Is that his sartorial style or his style of play from back in the day? I don't know. But if he puts down his cigar and takes off his sunglasses and sets to the task, then who knows what he might achieve? I'm sure that, North Korea has some talented basketball players. I'm sure that all they would need would be a good training schedule and we can see big things. But I wouldn't expect them to beat the USA in the Olympics. Let's put it that way.
Well, thank you so much, Chris Green. This has been a very informative conversation and hope to speak to you soon too. Again.
Yeah. It's been great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.